welcome back for another episode of Librarians with Lattes. I'm your host, Amanda Lau, Outreach and Marketing Librarian here at the University Libraries at UAlbany. Returning to join us today are Joanne Mulligan and Kelly Bartlett, two of our wonderful library ambassadors, and first-timer on Librarians with Lattes, Dr. Philip Eppard, professor in the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity, better known as CEHC. Thank you all for joining us today, and how is everyone doing?
Pretty good.
Yeah, I'm doing pretty well.
Doing well.
Awesome. That's what I like to hear. Before we get going, you know I have to ask, what have you been drinking today?
So I am drinking an iced coffee with oat milk. That's kind of my classic.
We like a classic.
Mm-hmm. I'm just having water this morning. Nothing too exciting.
Sipping on Hydration Station, right?
And a little chocolate milk to kind of start the morning, but mostly water.
I've been working on a Starbucks venti Americano.
Wow.
It tends to last me the whole day.
Got to get that caffeine in. I've been drinking water too, Joanne. It's been that kind of a week where I need some water. Well, let's dive into today's interview. Joanne and Kelly, I'll let you take it away.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Eppard, for joining us on our show.
Yes, thank you.
Happy to be here.
So we just wanted to start with asking a few questions about you. So would you mind telling us how you became interested in working in the archives? Kind of tell us a bit about your journey.
Okay, it's kind of a long one and a twisted in a way. I was a graduate student in a doctoral program in American Civilization at Brown, and I was working as a researcher with manuscript materials and enjoyed it. Ended up actually switching my dissertation to become a documentary editing project on the correspondence of Henry Adams and John Hay. And after I finished that back in 1979, I was looking for a job, and the job that I found was a project archives position at Harvard Divinity School Library. And because I had a minor concentration in American religious history, that seemed to work well, and Harvard didn't care whether you had a library degree or not to hire you for positions like that. So I kind of got launched on a different career track through that position, bounced around to two other soft money positions at Harvard before landing at the Archdiocese of Boston, first as the assistant archivist, and then as within 1 year becoming the archivist when the previous archivist left to go to work for the National Endowment for the Humanities. I was only at the archives at the Archdiocese for a total of 2 years, really. And in January of 1988, I saw a little ad in the SAA, Society of American Archivists newsletter, advertising for a faculty position at the State University of New York at Albany School of Information Science and Policy. And they were looking for someone to teach in the area of archives and manuscripts and some other areas too. And I thought, well, I was originally thinking I'd be a college teacher when I went to graduate school. So I thought, well, maybe I should give this a try. So on the last day, I fired off an application letter and then got the position. Came out for an interview. I'll never forget the date because it was February 29th, 1988. That was my interview day at Albany. And then a few weeks after that, I got an offer for a position and have started in September of 88, and I've been here now 34 years, amazingly enough.
Wow. So it was kind of like an unexpected journey.
And the conclusion of it, yes, was kind of unexpected, yeah. And I often think that I wish I had known earlier in my graduate school days about this kind of a career in that, I mean, a career as an archivist or a manuscripts curator. But it was not really on my radar screen, even though I was going to libraries and inhabiting them as a researcher, it never occurred to me the appeal of actually being in that position, because I like the research so much, and I still think of myself almost more as a researcher than as an archivist, even though I haven't been a practicing archivist for a long time, although I have done consulting over the years.
That is really interesting how you kind of find your way into the archives. So, you know, maybe your original degree wasn't necessarily in archival work, but then you end up finding it, like the student that you were talking about earlier. And like for me, I was doing medical research and then I found out about the archives and then I decided to get into the program. It's an interesting little journey that we all go down to eventually get here.
I feel like that happens to a lot of people. I've heard with archives, they necessarily don't start out with it, but something happened, they learned something, and then they move into that program, whether it be before grad school, or I even have met people who do it during grad school.
Yeah, I think that it was particularly characteristic of sort of my generation that people were in graduate programs, usually in history, and or maybe working as a student worker in the archives and discovered it that way. Now I think we're seeing more students, there's a greater visibility to the field, I think, and more students are coming directly from an undergraduate program into our master's program. So,
is there an undergraduate degree for archives, or is it usually just history people?
There aren't any real undergraduate programs in archives.
Yeah, it would probably be history or English, something adjacent to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know with library sciences, there is none, and most people, I think, do history or education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what courses have you taught, and can you tell us a little bit about them? And are there favorite topics that you cover?
Well, I've been teaching the Archives and Manuscripts class, which is kind of the core class for the archives concentration, really since the beginning. That's the one I've taught the most. And a few years after joining the faculty, I inherited the preservation management class. And I've been doing that regularly for, quite a few years now. Early on in my tenure here, I taught information sources and services, the basic reference class. I taught information sources in the social sciences, class that I don't think isn't even on the books anymore. And for quite a few years, I taught a course on contemporary publishing, which I enjoy quite a bit, because the role of the book and publishing in society and the history of publishing is one of my interests. But that has also gone away. In recent years, I've developed this course on the history of recorded information, and been teaching that fairly regularly for about 10 years now. And then the rare books class, which I, again, also have been teaching from the beginning. And I've taught special topics course on legal and ethical issues. When we moved into CEHC, they even got me to teach a research methods class for undergraduates in emergency preparedness, homeland security, and cybersecurity.
Oh, really?
Which was a bit of a stretch, but it was interesting because I haven't had that. I have some undergraduates in my history of recorded information class, but I haven't. Most of my teaching has been for students in the master's program, so it's interesting getting a full blown exposure to the undergraduate population.
Yeah, the CEHC school is so broad too, right? You can get information science students, well, information science, but you can get like information technology, homeland security. So you really are teaching to quite a wide swath of students.
And we've tried when we moved into CEHC in 2018, and we've tried to fit broadly across all the programs, and so some of the faculty from the emergency preparedness side of the house, for example, have been teaching the research methods class for the library and information science program. And so we've kind of tried to broaden things, and the information policy class has been taught now by a professor from the that side of the house, although so we're moving to a departmental structure in the fall, so that'll be a little bit of a change, but we want to still maintain this kind of unified vision for them.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. So Joanne and I were both in your rare books class, in your archives and manuscript class. Is there a course that you are particularly fond of teaching, or a specific unit that you really like to dig into?
Well, I think I really do like the rare books class. For a couple of reasons. One is I love books, and I love talking about books and looking at the history of books. But another thing I like about it, besides the fact now that it's the only face-to-face class I've been teaching, and I do kind of prefer that modality. One of the things I like about the rare books class is that it's generally something that's totally new for the students, that they, they haven't either been exposed to looking at books this way, or some of the mechanics of the descriptive bibliography project that you are forced to do. It's just a whole different way of looking at books. And I've had students say, well, I'll never look at a book in the same way after having taken this class than I did before. And also, as I think I kind of tend to say in the very first class, first meeting in that class, is that, you know, a lot of people come to get this degree because they love books, or they love reading growing up, and then they get in this information science program, and of necessity they have to be exposed and do a whole bunch of other stuff that in some cases seems fairly far removed from what their original passion was. So I think the rare books class some ways gets back to their original passion was that brought them into the program in the first place.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think you and I can both attest to this, Joanne. We'll never look at books the same way.
And, you know, because I always had this idea of what rare books was, and then I took the course and was like, I really had no idea. Mm-hmm. It was so interesting to learn about, like, the process of making books, and just, like,
the descriptive bibliography part.
It was hard, but it was so fun.
It was a challenge. It was a fun challenge. Mm-hmm. So kind of related to that, with our descriptive bibliography with the rare books class, we spent a bit of time in the university archives and the special collections. Can you tell us a little bit about, I guess, to our listeners, tell us about the archives and the special collections? What's so interesting about it?
Well, I think it's fairly typical of a mid-sized university's archives and special collections, which is to say that it's a combination of institutional archives from the university and also a special collections of rare or rarer books and materials and collected manuscript materials from outside of the institution. And in the case of Albany, which was a state teachers' college without any research collections to speak of, back in the 50s, that there was I gather a bit of an explosion in acquiring materials to turn them into appropriate research collections, and that brought some interesting collections into the fold. Although at least from the rare book standpoint, they were not really sustainable going forward because of the funding wasn't there to support a major rare book collecting initiative. But they benefited from faculty input, and particularly I'm thinking of the German intellectual emigre collection. That is one of their jewels, and brings people from all over the world to research the papers of these social scientists, primarily, who left Germany in the 30s and came to the U.S., clustered around the New School for Social Research in New York. So that's a highlight of their collections. The other thing they did strategically was to recognizing that building a significant rare book collection was not going to be financially possible, was to identify areas in which they could build significant archival collections, and focusing on public policy and being located in state capital, that made sense. So they built up significant collections relating to public policy work in New York State particularly. So from the archival standpoint, I think that's a good achievement and a highlight. Then they have the historical children's literature collection, which is eclectic, certainly, and not a rare book collection as classically defined, but more of a textual resource in a way for studying social attitudes over the last, from the mid-19th to the mid-20th century primarily. Although in the course of just building that collection, they've, I think, gathered materials that will be useful for the book historian as well. And I'm thinking what Joanne said about her conception of rare books before taking my class. I'm not sure that the way I present rare books is the way that maybe many other people would, because I take a very broad brush approach and more looking at the book as an artifact. The suggestion has been made that in the digital era, all books will become rare books, and that only, and so that the whole library hard copy collection will be a rare book collection as everything becomes more digital. That's a bit of an overstatement, I suspect, but because I think the physical book still seems to be with us quite a bit, and the e-book surge, although it has its conveniences and appropriateness for certain types of materials, seems to be kind of leveling off. At least that's my understanding of recent data.
I remember that was the big narrative in like 2012, 2013, right? It was like the death of the book, mm-hmm. and that every New York Times article was basically talking about that, saying, oh, now that there's the Kindle, now that there's the Nook, right?
Yeah.
The book is over, but it seems like it's still enduring.
I'll like read an ebook if I have to, like if I'm traveling, because it's much, I used to bring like 10 books with me on a road trip, mm-hmm. but the Kindle is much more convenient for packing, but I prefer the physical book.
Mm-hmm.
It's much easier to like flip through, and I like holding it, but that's just me.
No, it's not just you.
So are you able to spend much time in the physical archives, and is there a particular topic or collection that you are more passionate about?
I don't often get to dabble in archival research as I'd like to. So, no. every now and then, I have a project that I'm sort of working on long term, or I have had projects that I've been working on that if I'm in Washington, for example, for enough time so that I can spare an afternoon and go to the Library of Congress and look at some things in the manuscript division. I will try to do that, or if I'm in Boston, want to run into Houghton Library at Harvard. I've done that once or twice over the last few years, but not quite as much as I'd like to. And what I'm interested in tend to be literary collections, let's say, usually personal papers of authors, writers, or publishing records.
That's cool.
Okay. So to get back to rare books, so we know you collect rare books. We took a course with you on rare books. Can you tell us about some of your favorite rare books that you own, the collections or the highlights, or even tell us about some, I don't know, exciting auctions or some finds or bids? Just give us everything.
Well, I'm not the most systematic collector. I'm more of an accumulator in some ways. And We had to move. We sold our house almost 2 years ago now, and so I had a lot of books that I had to move out and dispose of. But in general, I collect, there are a couple authors that I collect. John O'Hara's 20th century American author that I've tried to collect most systematically. Then I have some of the late 19th century local color writers, Mary Wilkins Freeman, Sarah Orne Jewett, Alice Brown. These are New England regional writers that I try to collect fairly thoroughly, at least as much as I can. For back in the 70s and 80s, I used to go to, there were large book sales in Boston and Providence, and back then you could buy a shopping bag full of books and 50 cents each, and they were the late 19th, early 20th century things. So I bought a ton of stuff, some of which was really good and some of which not so good, but so I accumulated a lot of things, but a lot of my, at least my older materials came from those sales, and it was a wise investment at the time, except that I've been burdened with the weight of all of them over these years. I haven't done much in auctions, so I can't speak to that. Maybe the purchase that I'm happiest with, I guess, and this goes back into the 1970s, I suppose, but John O'Hara's first novel, Appointment in Samarra, was published in 1934, and that's generally the most people regard it as his best novel, and it's, as his first book, it's also tends to be the one most sought after by collectors. So I had pretty much all of his stuff even that long ago, but I didn't have a first printing of Appointment in Samarra, and I had a little list in the mail from a dealer, I think in Connecticut, and he had was offering a first printing of Appointment in Samarra for $12.50. And I thought, well, you know, it won't have the dust jacket.
That's what I was going to ask. Will it have the dust jacket?
It won't have the dust jacket, but it's only $12.50, and I should at least have a copy of it, even if it doesn't have the dust jacket. So the book arrived, and I opened it up, and my God, it had the dust jacket. So
what a thrill.
That was a real thrill, because even back then, I think a dust jacket copy was probably going for $500 to $1,000. Mm-hmm. Matthew Brookley was the great Fitzgerald and biographer and chronicler, and did biographies of O'Hara and several other American authors. And he is someone I had worked with as an editor of, would work with as editor of First Printings of American Authors. But I told him about this, and he said, a sleeper. In other words, something that, you know, you didn't expect to find. Mm-hmm. So that was my sort of the most satisfying purchase from that standpoint. So
that's a pretty good one.
That's a pretty good one. speaking of auctions, I went to a very interesting auction. Again, this is back in the 70s or early 80s. When was it? And it was a collection formed by a rare book dealer from Brattleboro, Vermont, named Ken Leach, who had collected 19th century dust jackets. And we don't think of 19th century books as having dust jackets, but many of them did, or most of them did. It's just they were very plain. And I think I showed you one or two in the class from the 1890s. Probably I got one or two of those at that auction, but one of the nicest things I bought there was a little box set of short novels published by the Ladies' Home Journal and Curtis Publishing Company, I think. Or no, well, I can't remember the exact publisher, but it came out around 1898, but it was about, I think, six little volumes, each with dust jackets themselves, but in a slipcase that obviously part of the promotion that was described in the books. And these are the things that just don't exist anymore. So it was, that was a very nice purchase. So it included a short book by Mary Wilkins Freeman, who is one of the people I collect. So
that all sounds very exciting.
So you had mentioned you have some long-term projects you're working on. Can you tell us a little bit about them, or are they top secret?
No, not top secret, certainly. I had a sabbatical in the spring of 2020, which was supposed to be a time when I was going to really get down to work on one of these projects, particularly, which was a volume or an edition of John O'Hara's letters, which Matthew Brookley had edited a volume of them and published them in 1975, I believe, a few years after he was in the course of researching his biography. And it's a very substantial volume and a well-done job, but it's 45, now almost 50 years old, and it lacks, well, there's obviously more letters available than he had immediate access to, but it also, he also edited some things out that were personal references to people that were still alive, and O'Hara could be very colorful in some of his language sometimes. So it seemed to me it would be a good project to do a new edition of the letters, either as a print edition or maybe as an online edition. I think I was at the new edition from Cambridge University Press of Ernest Hemingway's letters had just started being published, and it was a beautiful and inspiring editorial work that was being done on that project. So that partly inspired me. And I was all set to, O'Hara's papers are at Penn State, so they have the largest collection of his correspondence. And I was all set. I had my Airbnb reservation to go spend a week at Penn State in the library there, and then the COVID pandemic hit, so that kind of put the end to my sabbatical projects, at least so far as they involve going to libraries. The other place I needed to go and still haven't gotten back to is the New York Public Libraries, which has the records of the New Yorker, so they have a lot of correspondence there, since O'Hara published more stories in the New Yorker than anybody else over the course of his career. So Penn State only recently just opened up to non-Penn State researchers, so I'm hoping I can get back there this summer. And I'll figure out how to get to New York City sometime too.
Yeah, we hope we can get back there soon. Oh yeah. My gosh, what terrible timing. So we also wanted to ask you, since you've been so involved in the information science and archival track, what would you say to a student who might be interested in obtaining a degree in information science or pursuing a career in the archives?
Well, I think it's a good time. We've seen how people with our degrees, our degree can do all sorts of things. For the archives in particular, certainly I'd give advice to be as strong with technology as you can muster. I mean, the thing that I always say to the archives students is that we need to be, they need to be, up to speed on technology, both in terms of all the technology needed to manage information about their collections, but also all the issues surrounding the handling born digital material, which is what most things coming into the archives these days are and going forward are going to be. On the other hand, we can't forget about all the centuries of paper materials that we still have. So it's like we still have to know how to manage that and all the issues around that. We have to know the other stuff too. So it's the information needed to manage an archival repository today is growing, and it's not like new information is making old information irrelevant. So that's, you know, being prepared to adapt to those changing circumstances and having a love of the material. I think this having that research that research interest is always a plus. I did a talk at SAA about 10 years ago now about the archivist as researcher, and historically there's been some controversy as to whether archivists should actually engage in research in their own collections, because of there can obviously be some kind of ethical conflicts if they're putting their interests ahead of serving mm-hmm. their researchers. On the other hand, working in your own collections and is the best way to learn about them, to help future researchers and to understand the potential of them. So I think it's a good thing for archivists to engage in research, and it may not be publication. I mean, obviously doing an exhibition, for example, if you're doing a large exhibition or even a modestly sized exhibition, you really need to engage in material in a deeper way. Also taking advantage then of what you learn from processing collections.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, how can you be a good steward of information if you don't really know much about your yep. collection that you have, that people are coming in to research?
Yeah.
So kind of piggybacking off what you just said, where do you see the field heading in the next decade or so?
Well, I'm already feeling behind the curve in terms of the technology impact. I think one thing we've certainly seen in recent years is this whole blending of libraries, archives, and museums into one sort of, again, technology being the facilitator of this blending of fields that were, righteously separate for so many years. So I think that process will probably continue, and it's I suspect it poses a challenge for the archival community, which was less less of a clear separate professional identity than libraries and museums. So on the other hand, I think the archival perspective and the approach to managing collections and the sort of the collective description tools that or the collective description mindset that archivists bring to the table has proven to be valuable in dealing with digital materials, which are more malleable and not as discrete as individual books sitting on shelves or individual museum objects on display. So they still bring a lot to the table. There's the whole digital asset management piece of the puzzle too that I think cuts across all those institutions. So that's where a lot of the action will be going forward.
So an exciting future still.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Because, well, we all know, when I started teaching the archives class here, I was typing my syllabus on my trusty IBM Correcting Selecting typewriter, and I still remember the excitement when I got a 2400 baud modem in my office. So, and that, you know, that wasn't all that long ago, so it's very difficult when you ask me what's going to be a challenge in the next 10, 15 years. It's hard to imagine knowing where we've been and how far we've come in the last couple of decades.
And all the surprising twists along the way. You're right. It's hard to know what's going to happen even next week. So we well, can't really, it's not fair to say what's happening in the next decade with the archives.
Yeah, yeah. It's tough.
Well, thank you so much for coming to speak with us.
My pleasure.
Yes, thank you.
We're going to turn it back to Amanda. I think she has a question for us.
Well, before I ask the last question of the show, I'll say I love the conversations on archives because, believe it or not, when I was in grad school, my track was archives. Okay. And now I'm doing outreach and marketing. So, well. Yeah, you always wind up somewhere mm-hmm. from where you thought you were going to be, right?
But you have those archival instincts still.
Do.
Yeah, good for you.
All right, so we like to end the show by asking our guests what they have been reading lately, whether for pleasure or research. So whoever wants to start.
I'm reading Hook, Line, and Sinker. It's a romance by Tessa Bailey. Loving it.
Not surprised, it's a romance.
I'm reading Spencer's The Fairy Queen for school right now. Not really doing much pleasure reading.
Oh, dear.
It's not too bad, but it is dry and it takes a long time.
So I usually have like a couple things going at one time and then often never get around to finishing them. But for a while now, I've been working through a book called Charles Ives in the Mirror. Which, if you know the American composer Charles Ives, he was an innovative New Englander. And this is actually a book that is a study of his reputation from the early 20th century to the end of the 20th century. So it's, you know, I'm not a musicologist, but because he's been portrayed as sort of a typical American, or he has, you know, a devotee of transcendentalism, and he was figured largely in some of the American studies debates in the 50s and 60s. It's just an interesting, and I find it an interesting kind of study of both popular and academic treatment of controversial and I started reading a book more in my immediate professional interests called Filing Cabinets: A Vertical History of Information. So it's a history of the filing cabinet and how it had revolutionized information storage and retrieval.
You know, that sounds like it wouldn't be exciting, but it probably is.
Well, initially it's my sense is it's getting a little too bogged down in, you know, it's an academic book, so it has to be, you know, has to pay its deference to theory. So it's the story is, in, at least initially, is getting a little bogged down in communication theories, which I just want to, you know, learn about the filing.
Did you know, have you ever been to the world's tallest freestanding filing cabinet?
No.
It's in Burlington. Burlington, Vermont.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's close to my apartment there. You'll have to come visit sometime.
It's a whole attraction.
Yeah, I mean, it's on like top 10 things to do in Burlington. So next time you're around,
well,
swing by.
In Burlington, I plan to go up there sometime, so check it out.
What an exciting book.
Well, I've been reading, so this is Ever After by F.T. Lukens, which just came out in March. And if you like romance, I'm looking at you, Joanne, it's a queer romance. What looks at what happens after you kill the big bad in a quest. What happens after that? So it's very interesting read so far. But you know me, I'm also reading several things at once. But that's the main one. Well, I want to thank everyone again for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure. As always, I say you're welcome back if you want to have another conversation. To all of our Librarians with Lattes listeners, thank you for sticking with us. As always, I'm Amanda Lau. I'll catch you next time. And if you haven't been able to get to the libraries lately, what are you waiting for? We hope to see you soon.